Ladies and gentlemen, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome the OAPT 2012 to Perimeter Institute. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter. And I can tell you that we have been absolutely looking forward to hosting for the better part, well, over a year.
Yes.
Absolutely. So welcome. I want to just briefly make sure that you are encouraged and you know that we want you to enjoy every part of this facility. The square block building with all the neat shapes on the outside, that's the original 2005 construction. The Hawking Center, which wraps around it like a wonderful spaceship, that was just opened this fall. So when you're walking through, take the time to just soak it all in. It really is architecturally designed to support what happens here, to think boldly and in new ways, and to collaborate. And those are the two main pieces, and this building is designed to make that happen. And I can tell you, it works. You walk in this building each and every day, there's no way you can look at a problem just one way. You have to look at it not two ways, not three ways, but about 800 ways. And that comes right from the top, but you'll get to see that in a minute. Just in terms of washrooms and those kind of things, if you need to use the washroom, it's just out this door. You make a quick right before you go through the double doors. Know that the door closes very loudly no matter what you do. And I think now let's turn it over to Roberta for some opening remarks, and I'll be back to introduce our guest speaker.
Do I get the magic toy?
You do.
That's the forward button. Okay, let's see if we can handle this. Oh, there we go. There we go. Thank you very much, Greg. And thank you very much, Dr. Turk, for agreeing to speak. I accosted him on the sidewalk one day, and he was very, very gracious. He didn't have his protecting people around him at that point. Our theme for the conference is opening doors, opening minds. And I think it really captures what we're trying to do here. The opening doors part, that's the practical stuff, where physics can take you. And we've got a bunch of workshops that are focused on these. You can just see some of them here. Where physics is useful, where it helps you get the job done, helps you get a job, things like that. I want to draw your attention to that little asterisk at the bottom. We are packed. We had to close off registration. We've never done that before. The workshops are fit into the rooms. Okay. So a number of people asked me if they can switch workshops, and my answer has to be no. Can I ask you all, please, to go to the workshop that's, in case you forget what it is, it's on your little card here. Go to those workshops, because otherwise we won't be fitting people in the rooms. Okay. Very special mention for the people going on the IQC tour. After the talk here, you need to go get your coffee fast and go to the bus. So if we could all let the people going on the tour get their coffee first, because they only have 15 minutes, you have half an hour, okay? Opening minds is the other part. And I got some of that last night in the speed dating. It was really great to have a chance to talk to people, to talk about the big ideas. And again, we have a bunch of sessions that we hope will expand your horizons in terms of the physics and also in terms of the pedagogy, because those are two really important parts. There are better ways to teach physics. The organization, you should be familiar with it, but what I want to highlight is we're really unusual. We stretch across a wide range of ages. We've got university people, we've got high school physics teachers, high school science teachers, teacher education, and we are, starting last year and continuing this year, trying to reach out to the elementary teachers. So the elementary teachers are here. You are very, very welcome, and we'd like to hear from you about how we can support you better. I'd like to make two really big thank yous. The electrical engineering at University of Toronto has been a huge supporter of ours now for a number of years. They're the reasons why you got to stay in residence for $19.99 a night. Right? That exactly. And they also have been providing financial and technical support for the contest. It's coming up on May 15th. We've had some growing pains getting this online, but it is definitely the way to go. And Sean Brooks is here. He's got his laptop. He'll be out there on the break. You can actually sign up for the competition, and he can give you more details. So we're going to get that one rolling smoothly this year. And thank you again to the University of Toronto for that support, because we As a little group of teachers, we could not do it without them. But also really huge support for the Prim Institute. They're the reason why we've got 8 teachers from Northern Ontario. Yay! We got Timmins, we got North Bay, we got Espanola, we got Thunder Bay, we got North Bay. These are people who normally wouldn't be able to make it to this conference, and the support for their travel just starts leveling the playing field here. So we're really glad to have those northern people here. They seem to be very lively. I guess it's how you sort of keep yourself entertained in the winter. But I'd also like to point out that this is the second time that Perimeter has had the conference here. It's really, the conferences cannot run without an institution that's willing to support this. And when we were here 6 years ago, we had 100 people, and it's doubled. That's why I had to close off registration. I had frantic emails last week, and I said, nope, we're full. And I have a theory about this one. It's due to the outreach that Perimeter has now been doing for, I guess, 7 years. Somebody do the arithmetic for me. So there's Einstein Plus. By the way, the deadline, May the 2nd, I believe, has been extended to 2 weeks. Okay, so Einstein Plus is still open, but don't wait for the deadline. Right? It's a wonderful week. That's what completely changed my life in 2005. It is free. It is fantastic. You leave here completely excited, and you want to, in fact, get right back to teaching, but you have to wait for the summer to end. There are the teaching resources. Yeah, modern physics is very exciting, but how can I teach this? Well, Perimeter's been putting a huge amount of effort in developing resources so that you don't just tell students what's happening, they get to discuss it and experience and play with the ideas of modern physics. The student programs means your students can get special talks, or they can come to the ISSYP camp in the summer. And then there's the networks, the teacher network. That's where teachers who've been here at Einstein Plus go out and do workshops around the province, across the country, in fact. And there were 38 in Ontario this year. So I'd like to do a little exercise, keep you warmed up. If you have either been to Einstein Plus, have received one of the teaching resources, have had a student go to any of those programs there, or you've been to one of the workshops in Ontario, could you just stand up? And while you're standing up, can we have a standing ovation for Perimeter and the work they've been doing? Fantastic. I believe the Perimeter outreach is what has invigorated physics PD around the province, and it's really fantastic. You've ignited a fire. Last word. When you leave here, may I encourage you to share what you learned? Specifically, if you're a high school physics teacher, you have science teachers there who are teaching the physics parts in grade 9 and 10, and they need your support. They need some help with this. There's so much great stuff in the courses, but if that's not their field of expertise, they need the support. So you're going to maybe get some resources here, some stuff you can take back to your school next week. Or maybe you'll fit it into a workshop in June or the next PD day. So do share it with the grade 9 and 10 science teachers, and with the other physics teachers in your school. And get involved. You can get involved with your local physics teacher alliance. You can get involved with the OAPT. I can give you small jobs, big jobs. Our team has already doubled since last year, and I figure the more people that are involved, the easier it gets for everybody. So if you want to get involved, you can just send me an email, and I'll find you a job that suits you. Or you can come to the lunch at the very end of the conference. We're going to go out for lunch and talk about our vision for next year. So it's kind of an informal meeting, okay? And I'm going to throw it back now to Greg.
Thank you, Roberta. All right, it is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Turek. I had to summarize it just on one page, all of his accolades and accomplishments, so this may take a little while, but it's worth every bit. So, Dr. Turek earned his PhD from Imperial College. He was then appointed as an associate scientist at Fermilab. He was then appointed as the chair of mathematical physics in the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge in the UK. In October of 2008, he moved to Perimeter Institute to become our director. Among his many honors, he has been awarded the Sloan and Packard Fellowships and in 1992, the James Clerk Maxwell Medal from the UK's Institute of Physics. Dr. Turek, with collaborator Paul Steinhardt, has developed a cyclic model for cosmology, according to which the Big Bang is explained as a collision between two brains in M-theory. With Stephen Hawking, he later developed the Hawking-Turek instanton. Is that how you say that, Neil? Instanton. Solutions describing the birth of inflationary universes. Born in South Africa, Dr. Turek founded the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences, that's AIMS, which opened in 2003. It's based in Cape Town, and it's a for postgraduate educational center that supports the development of mathematics and science across the African continent. For this work and his contributions to theoretical physics, Dr. Turek was awarded the prestigious TED Prize and a Most Innovative People Award in 2008 at the World Summit on Innovation and Entrepreneurship. He is also this year's Canadian Massey Lecturer and will be lecturing in cities across the country. And on top of all of that, he's an absolute wonderful individual and great guy. Dr. Turek, come on up.
Thank you, Greg. Remember to turn my microphone on. Okay, well, it's a fantastic pleasure to be here. Let me just begin by offering all of you a very warm welcome to Perimeter. It's quite amazing to see this lecture theater full of teachers. I have to say that, in my opinion, teachers are the most important people in the world. I owe my career to my teacher. I had an elementary school teacher when I was six in Tanzania, 6 to 8 years old, and she got me doing all kinds of experiments, made a map of the school and did geometry and all this stuff, and it was all about playing, and she just encouraged me every step of the way, and I remained in touch with her for the rest of her life. Sadly, she passed away recently, but she was just an absolute salt of the earth who, if you measure the impact of people, you know, a teacher surely has more impact than almost anybody else in society. So I'm right behind you. You're all my hero. I mean, you're all my heroes. So what I'm going to talk about is physics, and it's a talk which mixes teaching and science. And if I have time, I may tell you a little bit of science on the blackboard at the end. But I'm very poor at calculating time, so Greg just needs to tell me to shut up at a certain point. Here is the best school ever, okay? That's an ideal school. Wouldn't you have liked to go to school there? It has some problems, actually. They're all men. There's about one woman. But apart from that, okay, it was a pretty amazing school. This is Raphael, the painter Raphael's depiction of the School of Athens, okay, classical Greece. And so in the middle, you'll see Aristotle. It's in the form of Leonardo da Vinci, but it represents Aristotle and Socrates. They're debating the meaning of it all. Over here, you have Euclid explaining geometry with his compasses. And then there's Pythagoras writing some theorems in a book. And all these wonderful people debating how the world works and how we should organize society and most of the ideas which underlie our society today actually originated at that time. But I want to focus on a particularly odd individual, this guy over here, okay? And you see what he's doing? He's sort of looking over the shoulder of the mathematician. Looks like he's cheating. That is Anaximander. He's the world's first scientist. And there's recently a book come out with that title, Anaximander, the First Scientist. And that's what theoretical physicists do, okay? We cheat in all possible ways Okay? So we look at the math, we look at the world, we look at the experiments, we try to figure out what's going on, okay? And we will use any available means to discover the answer. And that's what he did. And Anaximander invented all kinds of things. So the idea of a map. He thought of a map. Think how useful that is. He made the first map of the world in 500 BC. He developed measurement of time using a sundial and calibrated it. Okay, so he basically quantified the measurement of space and the measurement of time. Okay, then he had the idea of infinity. It's actually amazing. He looked at the sky and he said, universe is probably infinite. It's not the first idea that came to me, I must say. When I was a child, I looked up, I saw the ceiling. I thought, somebody's painted dots on a black ceiling. But but he thought the universe is infinite. I don't know how. He thought of the idea of evolution. He thought life probably originated from fishes in the sea. And so they had some very profound notions. By the way, all the tools of the building trade, like the set square and the level and all these other and key, lock and key, was invented at the same time, 500 BC. So this was an amazing time, and I think this is still a sort of ideal school where people do humanities and math and science, and they just think for themselves and try to figure things out. That's what I saw when I came to Perimeter. Okay, I saw a chance to recreate something in that spirit. And my first visit to Perimeter was in the middle of winter. That's a clue. I'm going to set you a physics problem in a moment. It's in the middle of winter, and they put me in one of the apartments, and it was overlooking the Institute. You'll see there was no Stephen Hawking Center at that time. And they lent me a BlackBerry for my visit. And so I took a photo. And what happened were these mysterious rays of light coming out of this institute. They weren't visible to naked eye. They only appeared on the photo. Okay, so that's your problem, to figure out what caused the rays of light. But when I saw that, I thought, maybe something interesting is going to happen in this place. and I think I was right. I want to tell you a little bit about me. Our first teachers are our parents, okay? And my father set his example, he said to me when I was 3 years old, is he went to jail. Okay, that was a big lesson. he went to jail in South Africa. And he was, there he is, he's sitting up here. These are all the people, about the same number of people there as you all are. They were accused of treason in South Africa for questioning the apartheid system, for questioning the idea that blacks were inferior. And this was treason. They were all put on trial. They actually got off in this trial. They had better lawyers, and they got off. But later on, the government put them all in jail anyway. There's my father, and over there is Nelson Mandela. So my dad went to jail. I wasn't born yet, but my dad went to jail in 1961 for 3 years, and for something he believed very strongly in. When he was released from jail, we moved to Tanzania. This is the birthplace of humanity, near Mount Kilimanjaro, the Olduvai Gorge, where some of the oldest human beings were. They invented tools and so on. So absolutely beautiful country. And that's where I was taught by the teacher I mentioned, Margaret Carney. And so she taught me to do math and physics. And we had this wonderful environment of sort of playing, looking for insects, and doing all this stuff outside. I have to say I'm not too keen on computer teaching. It doesn't compare with the real world for me. And did all this kind of stuff, collected beetles, did experiments, so these fantastic books from the 60s, learned about Pythagoras' theorem, and that's how I got into science. So I'm really delighted to hear there's some elementary school teachers here. And if there's anything we can do to help you, we will be delighted to do that. Of course, late 60s, when I was a child, the amazing event happened. There was the landing on the moon. And I think my generation of scientists, you know, that was the real thing that inspired us. There seemed to be no barriers, right? If we can land on the moon, we can do anything. And I think, sadly, our generation is, or this generation, for young people, is a much more worrying time. That young people are anxious. I don't think the internet has, even though it opens a million opportunities, in a way it has created lots of anxiety. And fundamentally, this is because it's a digital technology. When people talk about the digital revolution, I think it's... you see, what they don't realize is that digital is actually the most brutal form of information there is, zeros and ones. We're not digital. We're analog. Okay, we are much more smooth, continuous people. Digital is very harsh. But you see, even analog is only an approximation. The real world is quantum. And that's where we're heading. We're heading towards a quantum future. Digital is a kind of unpleasant technology, but we're going towards quantum, and I may talk a little bit about that. Anyway, so we were, the whole world seemed open to us. It still is. There's a whole universe out there. And we hope that, I hope that people will go back to being slightly more positive about the future as they were in the 60s. So when I was 17, we moved to London, to England. I lived in England. I won't talk about that. It's a rather depressing country. rains all the time and very crowded and especially now very confused. But I went back to Africa as a volunteer teacher. And so I was in a little village in Lesotho, and I lived in a hut like this one for 9 months, and I taught physics at math and physics at a school. And this experience just completely changed my life, to see kids in Africa enjoying experiments and learning and to realize that everybody has this capacity. And that across the whole world, there are young people who can do this stuff. And some of them very brilliant, but with no chance of really developing their talent. There are 7 billion minds on the planet today. Okay, and when you think what happened during the Industrial Revolution, let's say, the number of people involved were tiny. I think the population of the globe at that time was 250. Million. So there are enormously more minds out there, some of them spectacularly creative, and if only they are switched on, they can do all the same things that, you know, people like James Watt or Maxwell or all the people did at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That's all to come. The world has incredible potential, which hasn't even been... it hasn't begun to be accessed. Now, after that, I went to Cambridge to learn physics. And of course, in Cambridge, big figure is Isaac Newton. But it's quite interesting to realize who Newton was. And so I visited Newton's personal library. You know, Newton's whole library consisted of one bookcase. Okay, he didn't have the internet. Okay, he had one bookcase of books, and you think what he figured out with just that. But one of the surprising things about Newton is that he spent most of his time doing magic. Okay, he was interested in alchemy. he was trying to create gold out of base elements. And he's trying to discover the philosopher's stone and the elixir of life. Okay? He was a mystic, complete mystic. But he played with many things. And it just happens that one of the things he played with was mathematics. And the mathematics was the magic that worked. Okay? He just discovered that by using this stuff, he could understand many features of the world. The thing he focused on was the universe, okay? Because life is messy on Earth. I mean, motion and, you know, there's friction and air resistance and all that. Things are very complicated. If you really want to understand the laws of motion, you don't look at messy things on the Earth, you look at the planets, because the motion is so simple and they're just moving in empty space, there's no friction. So he looked at the motion of the planets, which had been measured, and figured out the mathematics of that motion, discovered the inverse square law, and F equals ma, and so on. And once he'd started this process of understanding the universe, he'd opened this Pandora's box, okay, of mathematical description of the universe. And the next discoveries were even greater. There was James Clerk Maxwell in 1860, who understood how electricity and magnetism fit together. And in probably the greatest scientific discovery of all time, he figured out what light is. Okay? So he showed that electrical and magnetic fields can travel together through space at the speed of light, and that is the explanation of what light is. And of course, when he discovered that, he discovered every electromagnetic wave at once. So from X-rays to radio waves to ultra-low frequency waves to microwave waves, all of those are described by Maxwell's mathematical theory. It has infinite predictive power, all based on very simple and clear mathematical principles. So Maxwell's discovery was, by the way, Maxwell was very involved in a working class teachers association. He came from Edinburgh. You see, there are interesting parallels with Canada. You should be aware of this. Think about ancient Greece and Rome, okay? Right? I don't want to say good and bad, but let's you may have that mental image in your minds. There's ancient Greece and Rome. And then there is Scotland and England. Scotland in the 18th century, there was a flowering of intellectual thought. There was philosophy, David Hume, Adam Smith. There was literature. The greatest literary center in Europe was in Edinburgh. This was the contrast with England. England was too busy building its empire, sort of forgot about Scotland. And Scotland actually invented many, many of the things, like James Watt and all these people. So just think about today. Do you see any parallel? What is the obvious parallel? Pardon? Well, you see, you Canadians, you're so modest. It's your fatal problem. You're too modest. No, Greece and Italy, Rome, Scotland and England, Canada and the US. Okay? So start thinking about this. I honestly believe that there is, 21st century should be the age of a Canadian enlightenment. Okay? 18th century was a Scottish enlightenment. Classical Greece was. There are parallels. It's a situation where you have an open society, where you have a place that's very attractive, can bring people with ideas together. And anyway, there are interesting parallels. And that's what Maxwell emerged from, the Scottish Enlightenment. And he discovered light. of course, Albert Einstein came along. You see, Maxwell's theory, very beautiful, stunningly beautiful, but actually contradicted Newton's. Maxwell's theory and Newton's theory, just inconsistent. Maxwell's theory has a symmetry which involves space and time. Newton's theory involved a symmetry with just space and a Galilean, so-called Galilean symmetry. So this symmetry that it was in Newton's theory was not, Newton has absolute space and absolute time, and this is not there in Maxwell's theory. But it took people about 40 years to appreciate this, the contradiction. And the contradiction between Maxwell and Newton led directly to Einstein's discovery of relativity. And here's light and so on. So the 20th century physics was essentially the period where all these ideas were developed to the full. And here is my summary of 20th century physics. This is all of physics that we know. Every single thing about the world that we know that can be written in physics is in this formula. And it works. It works to an incredible degree. Okay, so you can make predictions using this formula to an accuracy of one part in a trillion. We know the magnetic moment of the electron. Okay, to one part in a trillion. We can calculate it theoretically. It's 2.0 in the right units. And it is correct. It is experimentally verified to one part in a trillion using this formula. So I'll tell you a few things about, there's a lot of physics in this formula, okay? I'll tell you a little bit about it, which you may not know. So E, start with E. E is for Euler, okay? Euler was this mathematician in the 18th century who was maybe the most brilliant mathematician of all time. And he invented, so whenever you write down function of x, right, you write f of x. That was Euler's invention, that there are functions. Okay, it's a pretty big invention. He invented e. So when you say something grows exponentially, e to the x, like inflation or compound interest or population of a bacteria or something like that, the e is there. It's Euler's e. There's also I, and I may talk a little bit about I. I is a very important number, square root of minus 1. Okay? The square root of minus 1 is right there in the middle of physics. And essentially, if I have time, I'll explain how all of quantum mechanics comes from that I. Okay? That is quantum. When you include the square root of minus 1 in physics, the world becomes quantum. Then there's Planck's constant. Just a number, but it measures the quantization of energy. Let's see, I won't go through all of this, but Newton survives in this formula just as one number, Newton's constant, but at least he survives. The theory of gravity is Einstein's theory of gravity, that describes the curvature of space-time. Maxwell survives as this term, and then Maxwell was generalized, electromagnetism was generalized to the strong and the weak forces of nuclear physics, but they're really just a kind of riff on Maxwell. The basic idea was already there in Maxwell. Dirac invented the equation describing the electron, quarks, neutrinos, all described by the same equation, Dirac's equation. And then over here, Japanese have a kind of monopoly of ideas on the mass. This term gives all the particles their masses. It's called the Yukawa term, and Kobayashi Maskawa just won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for their detailed understanding of that mass term. And finally, we have the most mysterious Higgs, okay? And Higgs gets two terms, he's lucky. And you know, we're just on the threshold of discovering the Higgs. The greatest experiment of all time, the Large Hadron Collider, is happening right now, and they have some preliminary indications which point to the existence of the Higgs, just where it should be, but it won't be confirmed until later this year. We may have to wait for 6 months or 9 months, but you know, we're lucky to be alive, really, at a time when the mechanism which distinguish what the Higgs mechanism is, usually people say it gives everything their mass. It's not quite true. What it really does is it breaks the symmetry between all the particles. So if you ask, why is an electron different than a quark or different than a neutrino, then the Higgs is the explanation. The Higgs is the thing that differentiates between the different kinds of particles. And so the Higgs tells an electron it has charge minus E, and it tells a neutrino you have charge zero, and it tells the electron you have a mass, tells the neutrino it does not. But this Higgs is about to be discovered. The nice thing about this formula is actually where it goes wrong, okay? Because as theoretical physicists, we're not really interested in all the successes. We're looking for the disasters, okay? Those are much more interesting to us because disaster is an indication of some new physics, something we don't understand. Now, there are two disasters in this formula. One is at this end of the equation to do with gravity, that when we try to understand space-time and quantum space-time, we run into contradictions. We get infinities in our calculations, which we can't make sense of. And also, when we try to describe the universe begins at a Big Bang singularity, where everything is either infinity or zero. The density is infinity, the size of the universe is zero. None of our physics equations make any sense anymore. And so people like me worry about that and making sense of gravity when there are singularities. At the other end of the equation is this V. V is a vacuum energy, or you may have called it, you may have heard it called a cosmological constant. It's what's recently been discovered, that we have measurements have shown that the energy of empty space is not zero, it's slightly positive. There's a density, there's an energy spread throughout the universe, and this cosmological constant is now taking over, right? In the future of the universe, the galaxies and the stars are going to be diluted away by the expansion, and all that will be left is the vacuum energy, and that will take over. So our future is going to be dominated by this term, and it's a deep mystery which we're still trying to understand. So this formula has two incredible mysteries underlying it, and we're hoping at Perimeter that we will be able to say something about resolving them. This mathematical knowledge of the world is incredibly powerful. Okay, it underlies every modern technology. You couldn't build a smartphone or the internet or X-ray machine or NMR or anything, okay, without that formula, without the equations which govern those phenomena. It's easily our most valuable possession. Okay, this formula is completely priceless. Okay, easily our most valuable possession. It's completely free to share by people like you, and it's probably the key to our future, because if we're going to survive, if we are going to get out there in space and explore the rest of the universe, the only way we're going to do it is through developing our ability to understand and control physical phenomena. So I want to tell you a little bit about cosmology. How we probe the universe. So we're just modern versions of Isaac Newton. We're looking at the universe to try to figure out the fundamental laws. And this is how we are able to do it now, using satellites. In 1992, this was the first measurement of the whole universe. So the ellipse here is a map of the whole spherical sky. And the color shows the temperature of the sky. This temperature is the temperature of the Big Bang. And what you see is it's not completely uniform. There are small variations from place to place. This is a better measurement, WMAP, higher resolution. And these little fluctuations in the universe are what gave rise to the galaxies and stars. So these are the fossils of the early universe. Einstein's equation describes the expansion of the universe. It links the curvature of space-time to the energy in space-time. G is Newton's constant. And here are the predictions we calculated in 1994 with my students. I calculated what we should see for the polarization of this picture. Okay, polarization means the difference between the intensity of light in the two perpendicular polarizations. And so this is our curve. We were very proud of it. We looked at the temperature fluctuations on the sky on different angular scales and predicted what they should be. It's this bumpy curve here. And sure enough, the observations came along and agreed. And I was telling Roberta, Roberta asked me a very interesting question. She said, have you ever worked on a theory which was wrong? Okay, I mean, seriously worked on a theory for many years, and then it was proved wrong. And I said, yeah, lots. Okay. Most of the theories I've worked on have been wrong. Okay, it's not a pleasant experience, you know. You can spend five or 10 years easily calculating, doing computations, publishing papers and all that, and then it just takes one experiment to come along and bang, you're dead, okay? And for me, that was always a choice. There was, you know, I do want to know if this is right or wrong. I'd prefer to work on something that's testable, even if it's wrong, rather than just, you know, publish lots of papers which nobody will ever know whether they were right or wrong. So most of what I've done in my scientific career has turned out wrong, and I'm very happy about that. That's great. That's how you learn. You do things. By the way, that's how kids should learn. They should do things which are wrong, and then you learn from them. But in this case, I wasn't wrong. And here was the polarization of the microwave background, and the experiments got better. And by the way, there are no adjustable parameters in this prediction at all. So this is just predicted from physics, the physics we know, physics of gravity, physics of electrons and photons and so on. There's no parameter. I can't dial the curve at all. It had to be this way or physics was wrong. And so in a way, this was a very dull result. We didn't learn anything new. All we learned is that Einstein and Chandrasekhar and all the other people who developed this physics were absolutely right. The whole universe obeys the laws they came up with. Amazing fact. This 13.7 billion light year sized universe obeys the laws of physics that we discovered on Earth. Okay, we still don't really understand why that should be. Why is the universe so simple that it obeys the whole thing obeys these laws? We don't know. So what I worry about these days is what happened at the singularity. Was it the beginning of time? Was there time before the singularity? And we developed mathematical models, which ultimately will be testable to describe that situation. Right now, what's flying is this satellite, European Space Agency Planck satellite, which will measure much more accurately the radiation from the Big Bang. And it will tell the difference between this cyclic model, which Greg mentioned, and the inflationary model, which is the other model, leading model of the universe. But I want to talk a little bit more about teaching, briefly. Greg has mentioned this African Institute for Mathematical Sciences. In 2000, this was one of our outreach programs in Perimeter. You know, Africa is the continent which, more than any other place in the world, needs progress. And being from Africa in 2003, I helped to set up an institute there. It's kind of a small version of Perimeter. Here are the students. That's the head of NASA at the time, Michael Griffin, who came to visit. And this center runs, just think of Perimeter, but small. It's the same spirit. It's all of mathematical science, so much broader and less deep. Here's one of our graduates in 2010 speaking at the TED conference. So she's from a poor village in northern, poor background in northern South Africa. Mother was a domestic servant. And she's now a nuclear physicist, just finishing her PhD. One day she'll be a minister or vice chancellor or something, I'm sure. Very, very capable person, incredible person. And she gave a speech in front of 2,000 people at TED in California. And what she said is that education is the husband that will never let you down. She was quoting her mother. Her mother was a domestic servant, her father was an alcoholic, and so naturally, her mother basically put her through school and university. And this was her mother's statement, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful way to put it. Last September, we opened a second center in Senegal. And here we are, these are the first group of students. By the way, Ames is receiving 500 applications per year now from across Africa for postgraduate master's level study. And so we opened the center. Here we are having a good time. In Africa, people know how to enjoy themselves. So Canada's got to start dancing. I mean, obviously the Northern Canadian, Northern Ontarians have the right idea. This person in the middle is a Nobel Prize winner, by the way, Klaus von Klitzing. He discovered the quantum Hall effect. And wonderful guy. Let's talk about perimeter. So what's the focus of perimeter? It's a very strange institute. There has never been a scientific institute like perimeter in the history of the planet. Okay? Why? Its focus is very, very ambitious. Okay? It is the most ambitious focus you could possibly imagine. The focus is to understand quantum theory, the fundamental description of the laws of physics. Here's the picture of the vacuum, by the way. The vacuum is a pretty interesting place. The reason all the nuclear particles you are made of hold together is because of this going on in the vacuum all the time. That's called confinement. Your nuclear particles are made, your neutrons and protons are made of quarks. You ever asked yourself, why don't those quarks just fall apart? The reason they don't fall apart is the vacuum around them is fluctuating all the time and holding them together. Okay? That's called the confinement of quarks in the vacuum. So this is the vacuum, and that vacuum energy is what is taking over the universe. We also want to understand space-time. So these are the laws of physics, the arena for physics, space-time. It bends and curves. Okay, that's the goal of perimeter, to understand these things more deeply. It's a super ambitious goal. We've just opened the Stephen Hawking Center, which you've seen. And here's Stephen, helping us to build it. He didn't look too happy because we're asking him to lift one of the big beams. But he's got a hard hat on. Stephen has been incredibly supportive of perimeter. When I told him I was leaving Cambridge and moving to Canada, you know, he was pretty annoyed, and I said, but there's this institute, and the mission is to understand quantum theory and space-time, and literally his eyes just lit up. Wow! You know, no one's ever done that before. And so it was actually Mike Lazaridis, in his complete naivety and, you know, boldness, who just said, okay, let's make the best center in the world for this stuff. And took everybody by surprise, and it still is. So here's perimeter, which you've seen. Tell you a little bit about the physics at perimeter. We have a number of scientific areas, but really what perimeter is about is the intersection between those areas. I have a favorite saying here, there are no groups. People come to me and they say, how many postdocs does my group get this year? I say, groups? There are no groups. There are no groups. We don't recognize groups. Okay? We don't want academic silos. If you go to universities, you have physics, engineering, computer science, chemistry. You know, they're all fighting each other. They don't talk to each other. This is not the School of Athens. School of Athens, everybody talks. There's a free flow of ideas. And that's what we have at perimeter. It's right in the middle of the exciting stuff happens in the intersections between these fields. I'll tell you three of the most kind of predictable areas of science, which we're focused on now. One is quantum matter. This is going to be the electronics of the future. Okay? We all know electronics gave rise to the smartphones, you know, cell phones, the internet, computers. The transistor was the key invention that enabled all that. But a transistor is actually, from a physics point of view, not that interesting. Okay, a transistor is pretty classical. It just involves single electrons. The physics that's coming is quantum, and there will be quantum devices, quantum transistors, and they're now, right now on the horizon. The field is absolutely exploding, and they will allow us to make quantum computers, which will make classical computers, like the ones you use, look like an abacus. Okay, so quantum computers are a whole different thing. They can, with your laptop, you will, in 10 or 20 years, be able to have every book that has ever been written on your laptop. Okay, that's what that's a natural progression of the stuff we know. With a quantum computer, you'll be able to have every book that could ever be written. Okay? And we haven't really begun to think, how are we going to read all these things? The only solution, in fact, in my opinion, is we will have to change. Like I said, there's a digital world, which is very low-tech and brutal. Then there's the analog world, which is who we are. We're much more creative and interesting than digital stuff. But the real world is quantum, and that's where we are heading. And we need to use those technologies to advance our own experience and our own capabilities so that we can actually start to see the quantum world. And when that happens, all kinds of things will open up. So, sorry, I didn't mention this field. This is quantum field theory and particle physics. Perimeter now has the strongest group in quantum field theory, which is our fundamental description of the laws of physics. It has the strongest group, I call it group, strongest set of people in that field in the world. Okay, we have recruited, we have beaten Stanford and Princeton and other places in recent recruitments, and it's now acknowledged that this is the leading young group in the world. And what are they doing? They are trying to understand the physics at the Large Hadron Collider. So we have some very interesting people here doing that. I believe one of them was with you last night, Philip Schuster. And so that's physics on very small scales, okay? Black holes, over the next 10 years, we will observe black holes. There is a black hole in the middle of our own galaxy. We have the top young researcher in the world who is working on imaging that black hole using radio telescopes spread right across Earth. And that will happen in the next few years. You will see a picture of a black hole on your newspaper front page in the next 2-3 years. And that will be the black hole in the center of our galaxy. We will also see the evidence of black holes colliding and emitting gravitational waves. That will be in 5 or 6 years' time. So it's all on the horizon, and at Perimeter we're studying it. So from very small to very big. These are some of our theorists in quantum fields and particle physics, and these are black hole experiments. These are some of our physicists studying black holes. Quantum matter is in between, okay? So very small, physics on very small scales, very large scales, and then in between this quantum matter, as I mentioned, quantum electronics, this is what's coming. And we were very excited to recruit Xiaogang Wen, who's one of the world's leading theorists in understanding quantum matter, and he will be joining us at Perimeter in June this year. We stole him from MIT. So we're building this area up in collaboration with the University of Waterloo, where the experiments, huge experimental lab is now being developed. We want Waterloo to be the heart of Silicon Valley, the 21st century Silicon Valley. We call it Quantum Valley. Now, that's really not come out. Can you see it at all? Can you see the graph? Oh, you can. Can you see the blue curves?
Yeah.
Can you see it? Could you turn the lights off, Jacob? Yeah, turn them right down. Right down. Let's end the blackboard off. There you go. Right. Now, one of the things I have been saying at Perimeter for the last 3 years is we don't care about citations. Okay, we're not here to get citations. We're here to make discoveries. Forget about papers. Okay, forget about citations. These are some of the meaningless statistics people use. So let me begin by saying that I don't care what this graph looks like. Okay, this is not what we're here for. However, now you have to be very careful. You never set your priorities based on something like this. Okay? However, in January, the UK Institute of Physics did a global survey of physics, okay, and what's called citation impact. So that means if you publish a paper, how many other people cite your paper worldwide, then you normalize it to the global average. Okay, that's called the citation impact index for physics. So they published this article, and the amazing thing was, well, you see, here's the US. It's always been very high up there in physics. Very dominant early 2000. The UK, they were very excited about this. The UK under Labour government really invested in science, okay, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. And you see the consequence is this rise, this blue curve. Here's the blue curve. The UK overtook the US. They're very happy about this. But the graph also showed Canada. Here's Canada. Bang, number one. Okay. So I was very interested in this. It's very strange. And so I asked the company, this is Thomson Reuters, I said, can you please do this with and without Perimeter? Okay, and that's the two curves. The dashed line is without, and the solid line is with. With Perimeter, Canada is number one. Just became number one in 2010. By the way, they're still analyzing 2011. Haven't got the results. But we had to pay them extra for that. Another one day's work, they claim, to add this year. We're waiting for that result still. But in 2010, Canada overtook the UK, Germany, and the US, and it's now number one citation impact in physics. So like I say, this is not why we're here, but it should make you realize, you see, if you think about it, Canada's a massive country with a tiny population. This is all about quality. This index measures quality. Canada can become a global center for quality, okay? And indices like this, they were never designed for this purpose, but they actually, that's what they measure. And, you know, there is no reason why Canada cannot be number one. And for an investment of this scale, you know, of the scale of Perimeter, to achieve a result like this, this is something which certainly politicians understand very well. We have a saying at Perimeter, invented by one of our young researchers, which is very simple. It's that today's theoretical physics is tomorrow's technology. And there, every example of technology you would point to, I could tell you how this is true. Theoretical physics is always the first way for opening up the ideas that turn into technology. So let's end now with the School of Athens again, what we're trying to create, and with Perimeter, the modern version, and Ames and other centers in the world which are doing the same thing, which we want to work with. And that's what we hope is going to come out of it. And let me end with a shameless piece of advertising. So this fall, unfortunately, I have to write a book, which is not ready. But the cover is ready. So if you ask me where the book is, it doesn't exist. But this is the cover. And the title of these lectures will be The Universe Within. This is about how we have the capacity, which we do not understand, to somehow understand the whole universe within ourselves. And this is one of the most amazing things about life, about who we are. And so the lectures will be all about that. So thanks very much.
Okay. So we'll just take a few questions.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So we have microphones there and there. We can take about 5 minutes worth of questions. If people have questions, would like to take advantage of the direct access to the TED Prize winner, book writer, physicist who did Years of Wrong.
That's right. Years of Wrong.
So please, yeah, just step to the microphone and we can just go in order. Terrific.
I'm an elementary school teacher, so this is a pretty basic question, but the push towards mathematics right now is diagrams, equations, and journaling.
And?
Journaling. Journaling, like writing.
Oh, okay.
And I personally am very opposed to it. I think if a child can show the way they got the answer, they shouldn't have to necessarily show a diagram and an equation, and then do a little essay on it. And I'm just wondering if you, obviously math is the way to get answers, if, and I find many people that have a mathematical talent, so to speak, really don't want to write all that much.
That's true.
So I don't know, as a, what would your message be to, let's say, elementary mathematical teachers?
Well, certainly for elementary, you know, my big criticism, I guess, of the modern educational system is it has become a factory. Mass production is the name of the game. And basically, you crank people through, you standardize everything, standardize the testing. You see this at all levels. University, you force students to rote learn vast amounts of material, which they will never need. When it's all on the internet anyway, so why do they need to rote learn anything? You know, that I just don't understand. So that's the general picture, is I'm very critical about trends in education. I understand people want to quantify everything. You know, it's like these citation things. They just want to turn everything into numbers and just measure people and rank everyone. You know, we're not here to be ranked. That's not the purpose of life, is to be ranked. But for elementary teachers, my view is, for what it's worth, you know, that is the formative stage in a human being, that or younger. And if you're not encouraging creativity at that stage, you know, you're killing it. And so I'm basically totally against any prescription at all. I personally would favor discovery-centered learning and opportunities. I mean, you know, what's interesting about somebody like, I was mentioning Scotland in the 18th century. I think it's a wonderful example. The reason Scotland became the place where all these great inventors started out, you know, Stevenson, Watt, Maxwell, Kelvin, you know, all these people were Scots. Why? Well, because in 1700, Scotland decided we're going to do things differently than England. England only had two universities at that time, Oxford and Cambridge. Scotland made four. Okay, Aberdeen, Glasgow, Edinburgh, one other, St. Andrews. Scotland made four, and they made them publicly accessible. So the fees were like 1/10 of Oxford and Cambridge. And the second thing is they made 500 schools. And the result was that literacy rate in Scotland went to 80% in the 18th century, way ahead of England. Okay, and that's where all these people came from. But if you look at the papers of the time, it's all about the fundamentals. It's all about philosophy. They debated in schools. They debated, what is a cube? What is a sphere? Is it a real thing? Is it a representation of the world? There's no sphere in the world, right? There's no sphere. There are objects that are roughly spherical, but there is no sphere. Yet we have a very clear idea what is a perfect sphere. So then they debated, what is the meaning of this? And they went back to the ancient Greeks and Plato, and, you know, this was the spirit of the times. figure things out from first principles for yourself. And what came out of that was incredible. I mean, for example, one of the major figures in statistics now is somebody called Bayes, Reverend Thomas Bayes. Okay, Bayes' theorem. This was forgotten for 200 years. But this guy Bayes, where did he come from? He went to Edinburgh. And they were debating, what are the basic principles of probability? And out of that, he invented this theorem, which 200 years later is seen to be absolutely foundational. My opinion is that kids at that time should be questioning the basic concepts. What is the world? What's a number anyway? There's no number in the world. Where is the number three? it doesn't exist. And these imaginary numbers, I was going to tell you a little bit on the blackboard about them, but maybe another time. These imaginary, they certainly don't exist. Square root of minus one doesn't exist. But once you allow it, you know, every equation in math has a solution. If you don't allow it, some don't have a solution. X squared equals 9 has two solutions. X is plus or minus 3. X squared is minus 9. Okay? Well, it also has two solutions, plus or minus 3i. When you do that, every equation has a solution. So when you allow imaginary numbers. So isn't there a reason why kids can't play with that? People in Scotland were going to university at age 12. Okay? There's no reason why kids can't handle basic questions of principle. Instead, we try to pour down their throats, you know, memorize, I don't know, the molecules in DNA or something. And like I say, school becomes a factory, which I think is just killing people's ability to do new things.
Dennis, how about we give you the last question?
Oh, wow. When you talked about the internet, Dr. Tarak, the whole idea is that people have access to information, and we as teachers every day get challenged with questions that the kids bring to us from the internet, and we go, okay. One of the things that came to me was from Neil Tyson deGrasse was, what is the biggest question or the biggest answer to a question? And he gave his answer. Do you have one of those?
Yeah, but I think you have. I'm sure you have. Maybe you should say your big question. My question isn't any bigger than yours. What's your question?
I guess my question has to do with when everything started, and of course we learned a lot last night about asking questions about time at the beginning, but when things started, there's an idea and the power of an idea. My question is, you've mentioned this already, but how do we get something out of our brain to actually represent something that really, I mean, really exists? That's one of the deep questions that I really don't have an answer to.
So I totally agree. It's an absolute mystery about the universe, why we get to think about it. That's the biggest mystery. And for me, you know, debates between, let's say, Richard Dawkins and sort of slamming all the religious people are completely missing the point. There are things about ourselves, about evolution, which we don't really understand. Why did it end up this way? Why did we evolve consciousness? We don't need consciousness to survive. We don't need to figure out how the world worked to survive. Yet somehow we acquired this capacity. Is it quantum? We don't know. Okay, as far as we know, it's just analog. I mean, our brains are full of nerves, which are sending signals back and forth. We don't really see any quantum phenomena in there, but neither do we understand it. In fact, we really don't understand life at all. We understand the mechanics of it, but we don't know what sort of caused it in a bigger sense. I'm not a religious person, but I think it's quite clear that the world has vastly more to it than we currently grasp. My own opinion about how we will get to understanding that is based on the idea that we only really learn things from experience. Okay, fundamentally all of our mathematical ideas and all this stuff does come from our experience. It's all an abstraction of our real experience. What we have to do to understand the universe at a deeper level is to change ourselves. That we will have to develop a capacity to experience the world as it actually is. Okay, that means seeing the whole universe, which we're beginning to do. That means accessing quantum technologies and using those to envisage what's really happening. When we start to understand the world at a much, much deeper level, then we'll begin to understand who we are, what, you know, that's our only hope. David Hume is one of my favorite philosophers, and he talks all about this. And, you know, he has a line in one of his books that, you know, the next step, Hume is brilliant because of his humility. And his humanity as well. He's got all the Humes. But he puts everything in a beautiful perspective. He says, questions of morals and ethics, all very complicated, you know, really hard to fathom the right way. Science is much more precise. But you know, the complexity of the arguments is like a major barrier. The next progress, he says, has to come from growing our experience. Okay? So what happened is that Hume inspired a generation of experimentalists like Michael Faraday, who played around with electricity and magnetism and motors and all that stuff and discovered this whole world of electrical and magnetic phenomena, which then Maxwell turned into math, and then it became electromagnetism. So that was an example of growing your experience, and I feel that's what we have to do now. So people like me, I'm a theorist, okay? But I really feel we learn by people like me sort of provoking experimentalists to do things and measure things, and that's when we learn. Theorists are just kind of provocateurs. We come up with ideas. They may be wrong, they may be right. And then the experimentalists are the ones who actually check how things work. The future, you know, we can't predict the future. But I, in preparing these Massey lectures, I have to say I've become much more optimistic. Okay.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dr. Nicholas.
Thanks. Thanks.